After the toasts, Somoza invited Wilson into his private underground office in the bunker. It was kind of Hitlerian, Wilson recalls. Somoza would later spend his final days in Nicaragua in that bunker, vainly directing his army to bomb the cities of his country as the Sandinistas closed in on him. But that night, Somoza, flushed with the victory in Congress, was brimming over with bravado. The dictator was seated in front of a giant West Point flag. "I want you to know that dealing with Tacho Somoza is not a one-way street," he said, leering as he took a thick wad of greenbacks out of his desk drawer. He mumbled something about campaign contributions. "I almost shit," Wilson remembers. "I said, well, not now. I don't need any money now. Maybe in the future." The congressman says he was not about to take the money, but he couldn't quite get himself to turn it down completely. "It just looked so tempting," he says, remembering Somoza mentioning the figure of $50,000. "In those days, that was a good bit of change, but I didn't take the fucking money." Wilson says the rejection made for an awkward moment. In spite of this, the dictator managed to win him over. Wilson liked the West Point flag in the bunker, the dictator's easy American slang, his friendship with General Alexander Haig, and his bravado. Beyond that, they shared a common bond over Israel. Wilson's Israeli friends had spoken glowingly about Tacho's father, who had opened up Nicaragua for European Jews before World War II, and voted for Israel's entry into the United Nations. "He was a soul brother to the Israelis," Wilson explains, "someone they owed and supported to the very end. There was even a shipload of Israeli weapons on its way when Somoza fell." And Wilson was particularly swayed by the Israelis' insistence that Jimmy Carter's human rights policy was short-sighted, and that Tacho was by far less evil than anything that might follow. Most of Wilson's Democratic colleagues, certainly most of the American press corps, and eventually most of the Nicaraguan people, came to view Somoza as a corrupt dictator guilty of ruthless force against his own people. But Wilson saw him through his own peculiar lens as an abandoned and betrayed U.S. ally threatened by every Russian-backed leftist in the hemisphere. He was running a rearguard action from the Appropriations Committee to save Somoza, even threatening to torpedo the president's highest priority, the Panama Canal Treaty. But the tide in America had turned against such indiscriminate anti-communism, and Wilson thought he had used up all his options to rescue Somoza. That is, until he found himself face to face with the renegade ex-CIA operative, Ed Wilson. The congressman's encounter with this outlaw came about by chance because of one of those peculiar problems that seemed to beset Charlie Wilson. He had fallen hopelessly in lust with his confidential secretary, Tina Simons. Like many of the women in the office, Tina was curvaceous, upbeat, and available. But Wilson had imposed a most unfortunate discipline on himself when it came to romance. He would not woo any of the women on his staff. The smitten congressman decided there was only one thing to do. He asked a mutual friend to get her a job. As chance would have it, she ended up as the all-purpose office manager, decorator, and social secretary for Ed Wilson. Memories fade, and the name Ed Wilson may no longer strike a chord. But in his day he came to represent something new and evil in the American experience. He was a former CIA agent who, like Kurtz in Heart of Darkness, had taken to serving the interests of dark forces. By the time the congressman met Ed Wilson, a Washington Post article had accused him of working for Muammar Gaddafi, but no formal charges had been brought, and the renegade managed to make many influential Washingtonians believe that he was, perhaps, operating under very deep cover on some convoluted mission. The former CIA operative would later be indicted for selling sophisticated explosives to Gaddafi, or for recruiting hit squads to depose of the Libyan leader's political enemies. But when Charlie Wilson met him, Ed Wilson presented himself as a multimillionaire with a sprawling horse farm in the Hunt Country of Virginia, and a lavish townhouse in the capital, where he held court with a daring collection of former and present CIA men and other mysterious characters. Charlie had never met a full-fledged CIA operative before, and Ed Wilson appealed to his sense of what a CIA agent should look like. "He was taller than me, weighed about 250, just a very lethal-looking person, dark, ominous, but a good sense of humor and a good guy to drink with." The congressman took to meeting his former secretary at this exotic townhouse, where, accompanied by much alcohol, Ed Wilson began telling Charlie how things really worked in the CIA. Ed had convinced me that he personally killed Che Guevara, and I thought, shit, if he got Che, he can sure get that little turd Ortega, Wilson said, referring to the Sandinista guerrilla leader. This ex-CIA thug set off a light bulb in Charlie Wilson's head. If Jimmy Carter wouldn't do what was necessary to save the United States, then by God, he and Ed Wilson would come to the rescue of Tacho Somoza. A meeting was arranged at the Palm Bay Club in Miami Beach, Somoza's favorite weekend retreat. The dictator brought along his hot-blooded mistress, Denora Sampson. Charlie Wilson brought Tina Simons and Ed Wilson. Somoza seemed more than intrigued when Ed Wilson described the 1,000-man army of former CIA operatives he said he could mobilize to crush the Sandinistas. "We were all drinking, getting more excited, killing Ortega, killing everybody. And then Tacho asked Tina to dance." Everything was going swimmingly when the dictator, now blind drunk with visions of 1,000 CIA cutthroats doing in his enemies, began to fondle Tina. It all happened so fast that the two Wilsons could barely believe their eyes. Denora, a very fit weightlifter, began pulling apart the two dancers, screaming in Spanish at her lover, then ripped off Somoza's glasses and stomped them on the ground. One can only imagine how a military dictator must feel when humiliated like this. It couldn't have been easy for Tacho to return to the table. Perhaps it was simply a need to reassert his manhood that changed his mind about Ed Wilson's proposal, which had so recently enchanted him. But more than likely it was the price tag. Somoza was a notorious tightwad, and the congressman remembers to this day Somoza's look of horror when Ed Wilson said he could save the dictator for a mere $100 million, $100,000 per man. To the congressman's dismay, Somoza passed on the offer. He just said, "Out of the question." Wilson later observed that the whole exercise had been very amateurish on my part. Putting the best possible face on this maiden effort to hijack a U.S. foreign policy, he explained, "I wanted to try to do something to hold the Ortegas of the world at bay until Carter learned better or we got a new president." Shortly afterward, Somoza lost the support of even his country's business community. On July 17, 1979, with the rebel forces closing in, the dictator fled Nicaragua. It had not been Wilson's finest hour, and the disasters were only beginning. Just over a year later, Charlie found himself looking at a picture of a screaming Denora Sampson on the front page of the Washington Post. She was running from the flaming wreckage of Tacho's white Mercedes-Benz in Asunción, Paraguay, the only country that had been willing to offer sanctuary to Somoza. The killers had pumped 18 bullets into Tacho's body and face before finishing off the job with a rocket attack. Soon after, the man who had gotten Wilson into the affair, Representative Jack Murphy, was caught taking a bribe in the FBI's Abscam sting operation and sent to jail. Meanwhile, Ed Wilson had become a hunted man after being indicted for his illegal dealings with Gaddafi. Captured in the Bahamas, he was tried and sentenced to 52 years in jail, where he languishes today. From his maximum security cell in White Deer, Pennsylvania, he insists that he had always been operating under the authority of what he calls the inner CIA. The congressman's girlfriend, Tina Simons, suddenly found herself fearing for her life. After testifying against Ed Wilson, she permanently disappeared into the Federal Witness Protection Program. The Sandinistas, the communist-backed guerrillas who Wilson had tried to stop, suddenly emerged as the preoccupation of Ronald Reagan in his not-so-secret Contra War. Charlie Wilson escaped unscathed but unsettled. He had intervened, believing he was acting selflessly to counter a threat that the country had not yet recognized. His heart may have been in the right place, but his head certainly was not. And by the time it was over, he had managed to make himself look like a dangerous fool. It was in the aftermath of this debacle that Wilson slipped into his colorful midlife crisis. A despairing patriot, convinced that his country was headed toward disaster, but no longer certain that he would have a role in its salvation. For a moment, when the courage of the Afghans temporarily inspired him, he took off his stupor long enough to double the CIA's Afghan budget. But it was just for a moment, and then he disappeared back into what he called the longest midlife crisis in history. In retrospect, the Somoza fiasco was a turning point for Wilson, and only later would he realize its positive impact. He had discovered that even with a wildly unpopular cause, he had the power to intimidate the most high-level bureaucrats. And most important for what he would later do in Afghanistan, he had crossed over a line and, in effect, experimented with running his own foreign operation with a renegade operative who wasn't afraid to break the rules.